Welcome, Thomas. How are you, brother?
I'm doing well. Good to see you.
Have you been in New York?
New York, New Jersey, 2020. Days are not really a thing anymore. Location has also been sort of, you know, thrown by the wayside. It doesn't really matter where you are to a certain extent. You're just kind of inside and it's boring. Things look a little bit more vibrant in Miami.
Well, we do have the sun down here. Yeah, I was wondering if you could tell us just a little bit about yourself and background and how you got to where you are and what brought you here today.
Sure. So, in a previous life, before I got into Bitcoin and crypto more broadly, I was a swap and derivative lawyer for a law firm in New York, and then in-house counsel for a large bank. Around 2012, 2013, what was sort of just a passive hobby in reading about Bitcoin and the cast of characters associated with Bitcoin in the early days turned into more of an academic obsession. So started the transition to see what I could do or if I could make a full-time living out of transitioning to that space. So I had bounced around the space for a little bit. I was with a firm called Digital Asset Holdings in 2015. They were in ancient history a Bitcoin company that was playing with sort of colored coin solutions for tokenizing assets on the Bitcoin blockchain. But they became the first software development firm to really start the narrative around it's about blockchain technology and not Bitcoin itself, that there was a lot more to these concepts that could be leveraged by existing financial institutions and sort of increase efficiencies and open up a whole new world of capabilities with the technology, with the core technology. That narrative has sort of played out over the last couple of years and has become something distinct and separate from the Bitcoin space. So, you know, the vocabulary, as you know, as we've talked about many times before, is a little bit confusing for people, but the concept of a permissioned ledger or a walled garden is separate from, you know, these permissionless decentralized networks today. And that's really where I wanted to focus, like getting more into the tech weeds. That's where I think the true innovation is, and specifically with Bitcoin. So around late 2015, I got recruited by Fidelity Investments to move up to Boston and join their Bitcoin incubator and help them build out their early products and research and development aspects of exploring the new technology and figuring out what was possible. Fidelity was tremendously supportive of that learning process in the early days. And today, they continue to develop interesting new business units. They're by far the most forward-thinking financial institution coming from that legacy world when it comes to Bitcoin. Today, I run a Bitcoin investment company called Hollow Capital. It's a multi-strategy approach to investing in Bitcoin and the broader crypto asset class. The primary goal is to accumulate as much Bitcoin as possible, but also invest in other assets that have the potential to either supplement or supplant Bitcoin as that internet native digital asset.
And which assets are those, if you don't mind sharing?
So ones that we like, I mean, if we look at Bitcoin as sort of the what would be a decentralized digital asset. But if you look at Bitcoin, it does have some potential existential risks as the protocol continues to develop down the line. So if privacy is one of those things that could degrade the value of Bitcoin over time, we would look at coins that have other solutions to enhancing fungibility through increased privacy mechanisms. The concern there would be if you know, you have a bifurcation of good Bitcoin that are accepted and in the system and bad Bitcoin that are sort of blacklisted and kept, you know, kept out of normal course of business for exchanges and for folks that have, I guess, reporting requirements, crypto hedge funds, for example. You know, other types of assets that we would look at, I mean, in that privacy bucket would be like a Monero. I think Monero is probably the most used privacy coin out there, a Zcash and so on and so forth. If you believe that governance is a problem with Bitcoin and, you know, there will be future forks, we would also look at other projects that try and solve, I guess, the software development decision-making process in a different way. We could spend hours on either one of those, but at a high level, that's how we kind of like look at the space. The other two prongs for the fund, we like to identify things that are broken. So things that have either technical or economic vulnerabilities. More often than not, it's the result of fraud. Looking to take advantage of retail investors not properly diligence these types of products. And we like to look for opportunities to take the other side of those trades. It's very difficult right now. You can't effectively, it's extremely expensive and difficult to short any one of these cryptocurrencies with any amount of confidence over a longer duration. But as the asset class continues to mature and the infrastructure becomes more robust, and we expect normal market dynamics to develop and progress alongside that. We've also been involved with the North American mining operation wave that has happened over the last, I would say, you know, 4 to 6 quarters, as energy prices in North America become very cheap, very competitive with other parts of the world. We're seeing large-scale Bitcoin mining operations come to the U.S. and Canada. So we have been supporting sort of treasury management services for operations as they contemplate spooling up here in the U.S. and Canada. In addition to HODL, my partner and I are spooling up a nonprofit to support Bitcoin core developers. It's a volunteer project, as you know, so it's difficult for some of the developers to make a living working on Bitcoin full time, but it's quite important to continue to make it more usable for folks, more secure, debug, just, you know, continue developing some great, you know, features and use cases as we continue to expand the technology. So the hope there is to get more resources in there for the people who are doing some of that critical work. So that's a mouthful. I guess I'll pause there and we can decide wherever you want to take the conversation.
Well, I had a kind of a personal curveball question for you. Back in, I believe, March, where we had this big liquidity event, I always personally felt that Bitcoin was this great hedge against this economic uncertainty and potential inflation in weaker currencies, money printing, these things that are the concerns that get most people into Bitcoin and gold in the first place. Yeah. I felt personally pretty concerned and a little freaked out when Bitcoin sold off in March. And just basically tracked, and it still to this day semi-tracks the S&P or SPY. So that freaked me out, and I even sold off some Bitcoin in the dump that occurred in March because I felt a little bit disenchanted. And I'm playing devil's advocate here because, you know, I'm a fan of cryptocurrencies in general. But for me, that shock and how correlated it became really freaked me out a bit. And I understand that everyone was searching for liquidity. Everybody was trying to grab cash and hold on tight. But for those out there like me who felt like that is the perfect time period for Bitcoin to shine and to say, you know, we are the safe haven. And by the way, gold sold off as well. How would you assuage the concerns of those who are thinking that the bottom of the S&P or the bottom of the tech sector is still not in? And if so, why is it that, or how is it that during that next sell-off, Bitcoin won't just sell off like it did in March? Do you have any thoughts on that, given the macro environment we're in and where we're going and, you know, things of that nature?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we've been writing and sort of fielding that question probably ever since that mid-March spiral occurred. So, you know, at a high level, a risk-off event is going to cause people to sell pretty much everything. We're a long way away from Bitcoin in its, you know, 12th year as a brand new asset class, challenging the US dollar as the, you know, globally accepted store of value safe haven asset. So in something that is as jolting for markets as March was, March kind of hit, it shouldn't have been such a surprise because, you know, there were indications of how severe the virus, the impact of the virus was going to be. But I think once that reality started to hit in, you know, Milan, New York, Seattle, I believe got hit, you know, just before New York, maybe a week before. But, you know, when the market really decided to react, it was pretty scary how it decided to just seize up, and it was a sell-off across all asset classes. Bitcoin was almost more severe than other asset classes, primarily because of the exchange infrastructure. So there are certain options exchanges like BitMEX, Deribit, FTX that have liquidation mechanisms built in. BitMEX in particular got caught in a liquidation spiral, and it made that sell-off much more severe than it would have been without that mechanism, so to speak. They have safeguards built in for the exchange to operate and sort of deal with, you know, how it offers leverage to its clients, both retail and crypto funds. Some institutions trade on it, market makers. So that really caused the Bitcoin sell-off to be far more dramatic. Bitcoin did bounce back a lot faster than some other asset classes, which, you know, to me is indicative of that liquidation spiral being part of the reason why it was more severe. And sorting that out in Bitcoin really had it sort of bounce back faster than a lot of other asset classes, if that makes sense. So without that event, it was two things. The risk-off is going to happen to Bitcoin. You know, it's too early to say that Bitcoin is going to truly challenge, you know, the US dollar or physical gold. The sell-off hit paper gold because people needed to raise cash no matter what. I don't know how many people were running to, you know, sell their physical gold in the same way that, you know, Bitcoin, like retail individual Bitcoin hodlers probably didn't offload. But, you know, the institutions and the folks that were, you know, trading with leverage on exchanges, they sold in droves. And we saw how violent that was. So I think that the story of it being, you know, the story that the narrative around it being a store of value is a little bit premature. We need to let it continue to sort of do its thing. And I think it's really interesting to see Paul Tudor Jones start to identify Bitcoin alongside, you know, gold in that narrative. You have MicroStrategy adding a tremendous amount of Bitcoin to their balance sheet as a reserve asset. So the narrative has bounced back. I wouldn't be surprised if we get another risk-off event. Things don't look particularly healthy from a macro point of view. I think a lot of people are nervous that a second wave or maybe it's something, you know, more germane to the the financial system. But I don't feel like we're out of the woods quite yet. And in another severe risk off event, Bitcoin's probably going to go down. The question is it hit as hard as anything else? And how does it perform against a range of other asset classes? And I think that that is really a matter of perspective. A retail investor that looks at Bitcoin as sort of a savings account from a country that doesn't have access to the global financial system, the way a New York-based hedge fund does, are going to treat Bitcoin in completely different ways. One other point, just to expand upon that, a lot of people talk about Venezuela, Argentina, Zimbabwe, and countries that have endured, hyperinflation and sort of common failings of their national currency. There's been a narrative that Bitcoin is going to be, the saving grace for these type of users. It's hard to get core data on that. We have local Bitcoins, we have Paxful volumes. There's a fantastic website called usefultulips.org, it's either .org or .com, that looks at these and breaks it down country by country. But in the US, the retail investor numbers for demand are really not super reliable. But we do have quarterly reports coming out of Square. And Square's Cash App does offer users to buy and sell Bitcoin. And we can see their growth quarter over quarter is just explosive. And that didn't stop when the coronavirus hit, which tells me, again, that's another point that supports, my thinking on this. I think that, there's a big difference between the crypto hedge funds and the investors who are trading this thing and the folks that are accumulating it and looking at it as sort of a savings account of the future. That was a winding answer to your question.
Well, continuing on that devil's advocate narrative, do you think it would ever be possible for a government, our government, or governments collectively to either A, try to confiscate Bitcoin, or B, try to make it illegal to trade and or buy or sell Bitcoin?
It has happened in the past. If you look at FDR's approach to hoarding gold in the 30s, should be the exact year that happened. So it's definitely possible. I think the nature of the internet and the way that this has become such a decentralized phenomenon makes it really difficult for countries to coordinate to stomp out Bitcoin usage and transfers. If it was possible, you think that they would have done it a little bit more effectively in a pandemic to stop out the virus. If they were to coordinate to do it with Bitcoin, treating Bitcoin as a virus, and they were effective, there would probably be some questions about why that would be more important than like a public health concern. So I'm skeptical. I think that a country that takes themselves out of the innovation race is going to do so at their own detriment to a significant degree. And it looks a lot like countries that took themselves out of the innovation race in the 90s around, internet infrastructure. There were countries, authoritarian countries or otherwise, that decided that the, freedom of communication and access to information that the internet provides common people was something that was an existential threat to the powers that be in particular countries. And, a lot of them are still playing catch up compared to countries like the US and Canada and Europe and others who sort of fostered that early innovation. I think the stakes are much higher with something like Bitcoin because it drives at the core of value and monetary assets. So despite the stories of, you know, X, Y, and Z country banning Bitcoin or cracking down on it, we haven't seen it in any great detail yet. And I think that that's indicative of a real hesitation to take oneself out of an innovation race.
And as we see countries around the world, in particular, you have these weaker currencies, the examples you mentioned, Venezuela, Argentina, or Hungary, that have gone through hyperinflation. What do you see in the cards for the short, medium, and long-term future in terms of currencies in general, whether they are stronger or weaker currencies, especially as we have the printers printing at max speed right now around the world?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And I mean, we're all sort of watching the live feed. There's a lot of, you know, extremely intelligent people that study this full time. I think, you know, macroeconomists, Nick Carter's done a very good job. He runs a crypto VC out of Boston. He's done a very good job sort of framing the debate about whether, you know, Bitcoin provides a bridge to dollarization of other, for countries of that have currencies that are either failed or failing. I think we'll probably continue to see that. The dollarization trend will accelerate. I don't expect to see anybody.
So people, what you're referring to is people in Venezuela exchanging their currency for Bitcoins and then from there getting dollars.
Yeah, basically using it as a mechanism to acquire dollars and use dollars rather than using Bitcoin itself, because Bitcoin is still not quite a store of value yet. Another crypto analyst, Murad Mahmoudov, had a great chart that shows the progression of Bitcoin from a digital collectible and lots of things, you know, that it can acquire lots of attributes before it becomes a store of value, medium of exchange, unit of account. These things are built over time. So to expect folks in Venezuela or other countries to immediately skip forward, you know, decades and start using Bitcoin as full-fledged money is probably a bit misguided or too ambitious, too optimistic if you're a Bitcoiner. But it is a useful tool to acquire dollars, and that's in a risk-off event. And a lot of these countries have been in, you know, risk-off situations for quite some time. They're going to want to acquire dollars. That's the real safe haven right now. Getting back to your question, the I think we can expect a lot more of these, you know, smaller countries to. There's going to be a fight with some of them to protect their own currency. But we're sort of in uncharted waters. We're watching the live stream here. And I think that, you know, some countries are definitely appreciating the value of gold as a scarce asset. And I think that some are starting to consider the value of Bitcoin as a fixed supply asset, and whether or not that fits into their reserve strategy.
And so how are you, given the uncertainties ahead, how are you positioning yourself and your fund? Are you still buying the dips, or are you trading in this environment, or are you holding long?
Yeah, we are long Bitcoin. That has been sort of the overarching thesis for this, until something changes with the technicals. With the actual technology, not like, you know, trend analysis or anything. The technological fundamentals of Bitcoin, unless those change, we still believe that it'll continue this trajectory of becoming a store of value and chipping away at certain medium of exchange use cases. So very large cross-border transactions, Bitcoin starts to make a lot of sense for some folks and corporations. So yes, we're long Bitcoin. We are actively seeking out these special situations. We see a lot of opportunities in the DeFi space. We see a second wave of ICOs coming. Those were tremendously problematic, the first wave in 2017. And a lot of people ended up, I think, getting hurt with that. So this has been keeping us very busy. And there's been, like I said before, there's been a really exciting wave of interest from energy companies and oil and gas producers looking at Bitcoin mining as a badly needed revenue stream, but also as a waste management solution for some problems inherent in their business. So with that, we've gone deeper into the hash rate markets, which is basically another commodity associated with Bitcoin. And I'm happy to get into that, but hash rate are basically the computational resources that can be, you know, loosely refined into Bitcoin. And that is a developing market that, you know, mining operations want to see continue to develop, because they'll be able to hedge out hash rate volatility risk in the same way that they need to hedge out Bitcoin price volatility risk to run a normal, sustainable, projectable, you know, business plan. So we've been hard at work with that. But for the next, you know, going into this cycle, I think that Bitcoin and gold are essential counterbalances for the uncertainty we're seeing from central bank monetary policies as they evolve or shift to deal with a number of complications this year.
And what do you see, and you've touched on a few of these, but what do you see as the some of Bitcoin's biggest challenges in these coming years ahead, especially as we're in a very uncertain time with, you know, pandemics and things of that nature. I feel that we're seeing a continued rise of populism and nationalism around the world. What are those challenges that you're seeing the most right now?
I think that there's a lot of Bitcoin's path becoming like an established asset class is not something that can be like manufactured or engineered. It's just track record and time. You know, gold has thousands of years of a track record, and you know, the US dollar has morphed over time, but you know, there's, you know, 150 years of it being a stable world power with the ability to repay its debts. So, I mean, as a monetary asset, Bitcoin is going to take time, and people are going to have to, you know, become comfortable with it. You know, there's an element of infrastructure and education that can accelerate that or can hold it back. But, you know, nothing beats time in this equation. JP Morgan put out a good report that said, you know, when you're looking at investing or diversifying your assets in today, if you're under 40, you're probably looking at Bitcoin. If you're over 40, you're probably looking at gold. And I think that generation gap is something that isn't really altered by zealots or evangelists going out there explaining for the billionth time what Bitcoin is and why it's exciting. I think most people that would be interested get it by now. And you know, for those that don't necessarily understand it or want to understand it, it's just a matter of when the timing is right for that individual. To me, the most important thing is that Bitcoin continues to do its thing. Process transactions roughly every 10 minutes or so. No catastrophic network disruptions or base layer bugs that get implemented or exploited that are already there that we don't know about. Those are the important things. Whether or not we get an ETF this year, or whether or not, you know, China bans people from, you know, thinking about Bitcoin or teaching Bitcoin or starting Bitcoin businesses, that's less important. that evolves over time. You know, my fund is HODL Capital because it's a long-term progression. I mean, this is not, there's a tremendous amount of volatility, and there are volatility traders that are tremendously successful in Bitcoin and crypto. But I think if this asset class achieves just a fraction of its potential, you're going to want a long, boring strategy to see the benefit of that exposure.
And speaking of emerging markets, or what is said to be the largest economy in the world in the next, 2 years, China, do you, in HODL Capital, do you look at your long-term strategy as bringing in any of these projects from markets like China that may be particularly interesting, or even Korea? I know that they have made some traction with their Ethereum copycats and whatnot. Are there any projects that you're seeing from these emerging or rapidly growing markets that you are taking interest in, or you're watching? Or would that change your strategy if something came out that was faster, more efficient, et cetera, et cetera?
The Chinese market is fascinating. They're just so well positioned to adopt sort of digital currencies. Their payments have been years ahead in terms of using QR codes or NFC contactless payments, and they're just very easy touch points that are already embedded in how money is dealt with there. That you know, the U.S. markets and others are still playing a little bit of catch up on. That has kind of lended an advantage to China in other respects. So the vast majority of Bitcoin mining operations are based in China. The majority of critical infrastructure projects like mining pools, for example, are also based in China, which means a tremendous amount of liquidity, the exchange activity, also originates out of China as well. The U.S. has a real counterbalance. There's obviously Coinbase and Kraken and Gemini are robust exchanges. But going back to the mining side of the ecosystem, it has the potential to start to become a centralization concern. So when I look at Bitcoin and this asset class more broadly, the true differentiator for the asset class that drives value, independent of gold or equities or bonds or whatever, is the element of decentralization, which is really just the mitigation of counterparty risk in a number of different ways. So you can look at Bitcoin's decentralization through a lens of how it's technologically distributed, how many nodes, how easy is it to run your own node and interact directly with the protocol. Economic decentralization, how many trading venues do you have? How many stakeholders? How much do they have? Do they have, the control to, pump or dump the asset into oblivion? And then there's like a social political component of, how easy is it to coordinate change, updates to, the code base, or rally support around one idea as opposed to another. Bitcoin is the best in class, really, in all three of these buckets, the tech, the econ, and the social political. But decentralization is not an out of the box like feature set. It's not something that you can just slap onto your product and say we are decentralized. Not a security offering because we're decentralized. It's something where the goalposts are constantly moving, and it evolves over time. So circling back to my point, which was, about mining operations, one thing that I think is really critical is to focus on ways to further decentralize aspects of the community. So if there is a concentration of mining farms in China, or if there is, a concentration of mining pools or any other service, not to pick on China, this could be in any country. if it has a concentration, then, you know, finding ways to foster development in other places to mitigate that counterparty risk, so to speak, is something that's good for the overall project. So, you know, it's a real balance because, again, China has done extremely well. This is where a lot of the mining rigs come from because they've used that tremendous expertise in electronics manufacturing and semiconductor designs to produce the best mining equipment. But, you know, that could evolve into an existential threat for the broader Bitcoin community over time.
So, given that existential threat and your thoughts on the crypto market in general, how long have you been in the market?
In general,
crypto
for HODL? HODL has been around since 2017.
Okay. And how long have you been playing? And personally, how long have you been playing in the space?
The first time I read about it, and, you know, if I could go back in time, I would tell myself to buy as much as possible. But there was a Wired magazine article in November of 2011 that was like an obituary, basically. It was a retrospective. There was this really cool thing called Bitcoin with a really quirky community of, you know, libertarians and techies, and the price recently crashed. I think it went from like $32 to $3 or something like that. And the Wired magazine article was just like, let's take a look at this, like, you know, quirky tech story. So that was the first time I had heard about Bitcoin, and I was still in law school at the time. And the article was fascinating. I ended up, you know, poking around, and I think it was Bitstamp. I looked at Bitstamp, which was still in Slovenia. I think it was Slovenia at the time, and the price had recovered. And I just kept looking at it since then. I didn't buy Bitcoin until much later, which is unfortunate. It's easy to do it backwards.
Well, on that backward looking note, what advice would you give to a fresh out of school or in school young self for young entrepreneurs that are interested in this space? Because as you mentioned earlier, there are a lot of new cryptos being launched now, a lot of DeFi projects. If you were starting over from scratch right now, what would your advice be for some young entrepreneurs?
I really think that people ought to start at the beginning because we're still learning so much about Bitcoin, and it's so early. And that's not to say that you stop at Bitcoin. Like, you know, there's a lot of value in other projects and experimenting with this. You know, jumping in at like, you know, season four or season five is missing a lot of context and a lot of like important learnings that we've had since the beginning. So, you know, my advice for everybody is to the best of your ability. It doesn't necessitate you to like become, you know, fluent in C++ and really dive into the technicals. But to the extent that people can have at least a decent mastery of how Bitcoin works, it's going to help with any other project. You'll probably decide to stay with Bitcoin. If you decide to go with something else, that's fine too. But starting at the cutting edge is a good way to just, not necessarily set yourself up for failure, but I think you gain a tremendous amount of context and color from starting at the beginning. So dive into Bitcoin, and then it really kind of depends on who you are. If you're a designer, there's, you know, a tremendous, you know, cottage industry that's growing, focusing on figuring out how to make Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies more usable because it's still a brand new technology. It's not all hardcore, you know, tech and binary at this point. Lots of artists are also looking at this and doing great work, which helps with education and adoption, that sort of thing, as you know.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I feel like we're still waiting on that killer app, right? That makes using crypto almost blend into the background. Just like the early coders in the 90s, bringing shopping online to everyone's fingertips, right? It was making it easy and usable for anyone. Do you see anything like that in the pipeline, or what are your thoughts on the killer app?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of really interesting work being done to drive mass adoption for that. Like, if the killer app is really what gets it adopted, I think about it in two ways. So there's an example, Lolli, L-O-L-L-I, which is a discount like retail shopping service. I'm probably butchering the description, but you get discounts, but paid back in Bitcoin as you route to, you know, wherever you want to shop. That's obviously a huge use case for a lot of people who are new to Bitcoin. Lolli and Fold, but, you know, shout out to Fold as well. F-O-L-D card. Offer Bitcoin cash back, you know, rewards for, you know, stuff you're going to buy online anyways. Is one, I guess, like consumer retail facing killer app.
Was that a credit card that, I guess, invests the difference back or what into Bitcoin and then puts it into your wallet? Fold?
Yeah, I think that there is a debit card type product. I don't know if that's been released yet, but I think that they use mostly like gift card discounts.
Okay.
And then there's a mechanism to, I guess, pass on the value of the gift card bought at a discount, and you get a Bitcoin bonus. Again, probably butchering these business models, but I do think that those are both really interesting. You know, thinking about like what it means to be like a killer app. The utility value of it driving mass adoption, I think it's just like excruciating boredom. Like that's kind of Bitcoin's killer app. The fact that it is doing what it's supposed to do, and it doesn't deviate from that in any, you know, jarring way, really provides that that safety and stability that you know, I think we're going to crave in this decade.
So you're thinking that hypothetically it goes up to $1 million of Bitcoin or 100 or whatever it is, and it stays within a range from that point before rising up, giving stability, liquidity, and confidence to people coming into the market? Or what, you know, that's one question I want to get in is, and it may be a little clickbaity or whatnot, but what is, HODL capital? You HODL, but how long are you HODLing for? What is the target value that you see in the future for Bitcoin's potential?
There's flippant answers like infinite. But volatility is relative, right? It depends on, there's a lot of moving pieces to this. So, you know, if we're going to print an unlimited amount of dollars, something that has a fixed supply and growing demand is difficult to price relative to, you know, unlimited supply of dollars. So to one extent, it could be theoretically unlimited. Assuming that things hold their purchasing power, I mean, there's just a tremendous amount of activity. And I've done a fair amount of work on describing the supply side mechanics of Bitcoin and the fixed nature of that. to newcomers. And once you understand that side of it, the only thing that moves Bitcoin's price is the demand. More people are flocking to the stability and boring nature of that fixed supply. So relative to the Zimbabwean dollars, I mean, Bitcoin is extremely valuable and could be worth an infinite amount of those. It's hard to say, but I think that we're going to see it start to chip away at that, the total amount of value that's attributed to gold as a store of value over the next, 5 years or so. So I tend to shy away from price targets, if that's what you're looking for, but I don't expect us to stay in this range for very long. There's a chance that Bitcoin becomes a failed project. I don't think that we were necessarily meant to just hold Bitcoin at a centralized custodian like a Coinbase or a Gemini or a Fidelity or something like that. It has to evolve. Otherwise it becomes, just stuck. So it's going to be interesting to see how this story unfolds. But very bullish on Bitcoin. I think it's going to do extremely well in these volatile markets. We are long-term holders of this, and I don't anticipate, selling a meaningful amount of our core portfolio anytime soon.
Or trading a meaningful amount, for that matter?
No.
With leverage?
Leverage. You have the most exciting financial asset in the world, and people still feel the need to put 100x leverage on top of it. If Bitcoin will just do its thing, people will be happy. You don't got to get crazy and strap like rocket boosters.
Like it's not volatile enough. I've never understood that, why people need to put on these 10, 20, 100x leverage onto these assets. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
It's like unless you want to wreck your portfolio, like completely.
There's an element of adrenaline junkie behavior to it. And some people can do it. Look, there are people who are very skilled at that. And as long as the, nascent realities of exchange infrastructure doesn't kill you, it could be a good strategy, but that's not ours. We like to take an insane bleeding edge asset class and try and wrangle a somewhat conservative approach. This is a long-term, development.
And by long-term, you mean 5, 10, 20, 30 years. What are you looking at?
I mean, we're what, 12 years old? Less? 11 years old? And out of that, out of the total lifetime of Bitcoin, how much of it has been actually tradable by anyone other than just a retail investor? Most hedge funds still can't get meaningful exposure. They have to go through other products like the Bitcoin Investment Trust, or they're trading CME paper options. But there are very few, financial institutions, like traditional financial institutions, that are getting direct exposure to Bitcoin still. So, the next 5 years, if we see a meaningful push into that segment, it's going to be the first meaningful push into that segment. Except for around the edges, you have Andreessen Horowitz and other folks making like crypto venture accessible, but direct ownership of Bitcoin, of the underlying asset itself, is still not quite there yet. So a 3 to 5 year horizon is 30-50% of Bitcoin's life to date. So it's going to be insane to see the pace of adoption and development increase over that time period. Products out of Fidelity, with Fidelity Digital Asset Service and Square's Cash App, have been live for a year, maybe a little bit more. So that critical infrastructure component is still, just unfolding. As that becomes more ubiquitous and robust, you get the on and off ramps at like a much more sophisticated level. That makes the demand side a lot easier. And as I mentioned before, the supply side is fixed. And that needs to remain constant and super boring. And when you continue to develop out the infrastructure for folks to buy it, who want access to Bitcoin, that's where things start to get really exciting.
Well, awesome, Thomas.
It's going to go up.
What's that?
I believe it's going to go up. This is not investment advice, of course, all the usual disclaimers, but I love the stuff.
Well,
and there's a fascinating world beyond it, too.
And where can people find you, website URL or on Twitter? What's the best way to be in touch?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter, first initial, last name, Tpacchia, T-P-A-C-C-H-I-A. DMs are open.
And Hodl Capital's website?
It's hodl.capital, H-O-D-L.capital.
All right. Awesome. Well, Thanks, Thomas, thank you so much, and we'll speak soon.
All right.